Hello and welcome to In the Spotlight podcast. Myself, Bill Cummings. Today, I am joined by Darren Heyman.
Hello.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Yeah, I'm fine.
Been in the garden today?
I don't have a garden. I have an allotment.
Allotment.
And so
Have you been in the allotment today?
I've been in the allotment, and I've been planting out cucumbers and tomatoes today.
Lovely. What's the weather like where you are? Because it's sort of gone off here, which I'm sort of thankful of, to be honest.
It's okay. It's all right. It's bright, but not too hot. It's all right.
Whereabouts do you live?
It's easier to say Crystal Palace in South London.
Ah, okay.
But I actually live on the Sydenham-Penge border, and my allotment is too far away, really. The exercise with the allotment is getting there, really. I'm sort of terrible at it. But this year I may be a little less terrible than I've been other years. I think of music and art as trying to make temporary things permanent. You're trying to make fleeting feelings or moments and give them some permanence, be it on a piece of paper or a record.
Yeah.
Whereas with the allotment and growing vegetables and plants, everything is temporary.
Yeah.
Everything is fleeting. Nothing lasts. And it's an incredible amount of work for a couple of tomatoes. It's really, really stupid. No one should do it.
Yeah, because my mum is always encouraging me to garden because she volunteers in a sort of community garden in Cardiff. So yeah, I'm sure I'll get into it at some point, but currently I live in a one-bedroom flat with no garden. So
I do live in a two-bedroom flat with no garden. Like I've had to pull strings to make this happen.
Find an outlet for it, like an allotment. Yeah, yeah.
I actually wouldn't recommend it. It's actually crushing when things die, and there's no logic to it, and it's incredibly unfair. And I've been doing it for about 6 years now. I've had the allotment, and I don't really know why I'm doing it. Every year I say, oh, I think I'll give up this year. And then I just do it for another year, and I don't really know why.
You get something at the end of it. Food? Do you get food at the end of it?
No, I'm genuinely trying to think why I do it. Yes, you get some food, but like the economics of it are insane. Each potato is probably costing me a fiver or something. Why do I do it? There is something about something happening from nothing. There's something about like a tomato seed is incredibly tiny. It's like barely a grain of dust or something. And the fact that you plant this thing and by nurturing it, and just actually what happens in terms of mass and physics is sometimes amazing. It's like, oh, just sun and water turned this into a plant that's a meter high. And just the fact that that seed was encoded with all that information.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite an amazing thing to see and to feel and to feel responsible for it. So there you go. There's a good thing about it.
The close I've got is I've got a couple of plants here and they're just sort of like unruly, sort of growing everywhere. But they're still alive.
I used to have nothing. I used to not have anything green around me at all. I didn't have plants at all. And I think that is a bit weird. I think we should all even if it's just one shit, you know, succulent or a spider plant, we should all have at least one thing dying in front of us.
Yeah, especially when you live in the city, it's like there is that, and that might link to something one of your other projects, your Thankful Villagers project, which I found quite interesting to look at because I didn't really know much about it. So that idea of like craving sort of being out of the city sort of.
A Thankful Village is a village where every soldier returned alive from World War One, and there's about, I think there's 54, 55 villages. There's a couple of guys who decide whether a village is or isn't, and sometimes they decide one is, and then one gets disqualified because they found someone who died or something like that.
Yeah.
And when I found out about it, it was one of those rare things, a subject which only had one shaky Wikipedia entry in this one website. And so, yeah, like you, one of the main reasons why I decided to do it was simply that no one else had. Just that, oh, this is weird. No one else seems to have happened upon this.
Yeah.
And then after, so what I decided to do was visit every thankful village and do something in each village. It wouldn't be quite fair to say I recorded a song in every one. Some of them are sort of soundscapey things. Some of them are interviews with people in the village, set to a backing. Sometimes I was even kind of curating it rather than creating it. So sometimes I was saying, hey, how about you who lives nearby, why don't you play something and you talk over it? So sometimes it wasn't even so much that I was even composing. And what they sort of sound like is, to me, they kind of sound like sort of slightly abstracted radio shows, really, rather than albums. But in answer to your question about rural life versus city life, it was a project that constantly took me out of London for long stretches of time. And it did challenge and confound my prejudices. Mm-hmm. I think I did have some prejudices about the countryside, which were wrong. I still live in the city, but I definitely felt like it wasn't impossible that I could live in the countryside after doing that project. I had a lot more sympathy and empathy and understood the countryside a lot more after that, during that project.
Yeah. The artwork is quite key to it as well, isn't it? Just looking at it.
I overdid it a little bit on that project. I kind of said, Each village, there's a website, and each village has a painting that I did whilst I was there.
Mm.
There's some kind of film or video. Sometimes it's a collection of photographs. There's a slideshow. Sometimes it's a film and a song. And like a lot of us now, in the time we live in, I find it easier to view this kind of activity as ADHD and something that needs to be medicated. Whereas at the time I just sort of thought, oh God, I'm so creative, I'm so hardworking.
Yeah.
And I am, you know, I'm not uncreative, I'm not hardworking. But now I look at something like that and see two things. I see the work, and I like the work, and I really do love that project. But I also think, God, why was it necessary to do a painting, a video, and a song in everything?
Yeah. That is actually, it's funny you mention that, because looking at the entire body of things you've been up to in the last, 30 years, it just, it's so much. And I did wonder, because you seem to have like a toe in, or a, you know, hand in a lot of different artistic and creative pursuits and things. And is there an element of like you said, almost there's like a restlessness a little bit, where you feel like you want to be creative all the time? Or is it more just, if something really strikes your passion, a bit like this project here, then you sort of go full into it and you get almost carried away?
I think there's lots to say, really. I'm only pausing because I'm trying to think of the right way into it. I try not to use words like passion. There's nothing wrong with that, really. Mm. I just find it really natural. Mm. And when I was young and I would make up comic maps and draw them. I would even then, like, you know, my friend Phil, who also do comics, would come around my house and go, "Hold on, you've done all this weekend. How did you do that?" And I said, "Well, I didn't do anything else. I just ate and I just drew comics all weekend." Mm. It's taken me a little while to it's taken me a little while to realize everyone isn't like this.
Yeah.
And I tell this story quite often, and I wouldn't name any names, but a couple of years ago, I was working in a shop above a recording studio that I used to record in a lot as well. And two guys that I knew went down there and were down there for a couple of hours, and they came up and I said to them, "You finished, you know, you're done." And they went, "Yeah, just not feeling it. You know what I mean? When the vibe's not there, you can't do it, can you?" Mm. And they sort of both did a shrug thing, and I sort of nodded as if I agreed. But inside, I thought, "No, I don't understand what you're talking about. I have no idea what you're describing. If I'm in a recording studio, and especially if it's free, I will always find something to do.
Mm.
I'm never bored. I always want to do it all the time, forever, all the time." And it's the same now with bands I have now. You know, I remember recording November, and it gets to sort of 7 or 8 o'clock, and recording for eight or nine o'clock, and somebody in the band or the producer say, "Oh, should we call it a day then? That's enough, isn't it?" And I have to pretend I agree, and I go, yeah, great, let's end. But I don't want to stop.
Yeah.
If somebody said, "Shall we just carry on doing this till 5 in the morning? I've said, "Yeah, sure. Let's get some coffee. Let's just record 4 more songs. And I've always been that person. And only on about 2 or 3 occasions can I remember meeting someone who I felt the same. So that sounds very braggadocious, but it sort of is true. I don't really understand other musicians. I don't really understand. It was like Peter Gabriel released a song yesterday, and I didn't read the article, but the headline was something like, "I've been tinkering with this single for decades." It's like, what? I don't understand what that would be. Like, how can you work on a song for decades? I just can't understand what that would be like. I like him too. I like Peter Gabriel. I think they're great. Yeah. I think the songs are great, but I still just don't understand how he's only released, I don't know, 6 records or something in his entire life. That's a joke. I think he has at least more than 6.
Yeah.
I'm going to slay another sacred cow on this. I was like, when George Michael died, everyone was like, "Oh, it's a shame." And it is a shame. It's a shame George Michael died. I'm very sorry George Michael died. And everyone was like, "Oh, yeah, we've lost all that work. I was like, "Are you kidding me? He made 4 albums in about 30 years. I mean, he probably was very nice. He did a lot of work for charity. Clearly, he smoked too much dope, and he could have done a bit more work. He was a little bit lazy."
Yeah, well, I suppose it depends on your perspective, doesn't it? Maybe he's this kind of perfectionist type person who, like you said, but in a lot of ways, that sometimes you can spend too much time on something and then you end up procrastinating to the point where you don't release it.
Yeah, and I think a fault of mine and a criticism I would level myself is that it's all very well churning stuff out all the time, Darren, but could it sometimes be a bit better? And could you sometimes be a bit more of a perfectionist? And I think that's true. I probably could. I think part of wanting to be busy all the time and do stuff means that I have quite an impatient mind.
Yeah.
And something that allows me to do work so quickly is, you know, having been influenced by American lo-fi recording and very scrappy records. And also doing recording in challenging situations anyway. So, you know, if I'm recording a song in a field on my phone with, you know, just a dustbin lid, you know, it sounds like it's recorded in a field on the phone in a dustbin lid. So one reason I'm able to do things so quickly is that I I love things to sound unfinished and unkempt. And so a criticism could be, Darren, maybe if you recorded things properly, you know, your records might sound a bit more like Peter Gabriel's, and you might do less, but they might sell more.
But then it wouldn't be reflection of you, would it, as a personality and the way you want to do things? So I suppose there are arguments on both sides, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. and I see it.
But yeah, I see what you're saying. Like certain labels would say to you, well, if you could, you know, maybe slim that album down to, you know, 10 or 12 tracks and pick out the most commercial, six music sounding track. And this,
well, the thing with Thankful Villages was that there are Thankful Villages, of which there's 55, and then there are doubly Thankful Villages, and doubly Thankful Villages are villages where every soldier returned home from World War One and World War Two.
Oh, right.
And I think there's something like 12 or 14 doubly Thankful Villages. So if I decided to call the record Doubly Thankful Villages, it would have just been 12 songs and it would be a normal record rather than three records. And I thought quite a bit about this. And the reason why I couldn't do it is just that Doubly Thankful Village is such a crap title. Whereas Thankful Villages is such a neater title.
Yeah.
So because of the way the titles sound, I had to make three times as much music. And that's why I'm stupid.
Well, you're seeing a project through there. I mean, just when you were talking about releasing music and stuff, it made me think of often when I'm interviewing an artist or something, they'll say, well, actually, I wrote this album 18 months ago. You know, it's quite old news to me. Is there an appeal like the fact of you want to try and get out things that, you know, are more reflective of what you're interested in at that point, you know?
I don't think that's too different for me. I have that experience too.
Okay.
The lag of releasing something can be 18 months. And perhaps not. Perhaps because I'm a small artist and work with small labels, perhaps it's not always that long. Hmm. But it can be that long. It can be a year.
Just to get vinyl, you know, produced. And
yeah, like I think the waiting list isn't so bad. It all went a bit weird after COVID because.
Yeah.
Didn't Adele press up 50 billion copies of her album and use up all the world's oil or something?
Yeah, Ed Sheeran as well, I believe, yeah.
Okay, let's blame it, man. That's better. Let's blame Ed Sheeran. But I think that's a little better now. I don't know. I honestly don't know. It just everything slows up. That's all right. I think once again, the difference between me and some people is I think some people go, oh, I really want the album to come out so people can hear it.
Yeah.
And so I can tour it. And I don't care that much. I mean, I do care. I do artwork. I do records because I want people to hear them. But I'm quite happy to carry on with another one. And so when it comes to interviewing, I just have to get my head back to, oh, what was I thinking about this record when I made it? I don't mind it that much.
So it's more the process almost.
I like the idea of releasing some things really quickly.
Yeah.
But I think the difference between me and other people is other people probably spend that 18 months waiting for the record to come out. Whereas I just make another one.
Yeah, it's like a constant rolling process. So talking about that a bit, you're sort of in the middle of what do you call it? Sort of tidying up your digital back catalogue and sort of.
Well, yeah, I mean.
That available that weren't before. And that includes the album from 2012, The Violence.
Yeah. Jamie Halliday from Audio and Hero just sort of said, do you realize what a mess all of that is in online, partly because I release so much and partly because I release things under slightly different names. I often like having it being Darren Heyman and the something. So that gives Spotify and the algorithm a headache. And also I think it's a byproduct of what we've just been talking about as well. Let's say a disorganized mind. I'm not a natural archivist. I'm not someone who puts my books in order.
Yeah.
When I say books, I mean all of them. I mean my accounts, and I mean the books on my shelves. So really, I don't have to do much here. Someone's doing it for me. And I suppose it's weird what legacy is, really. What is legacy now? And I suppose at one point I might have enjoyed having a row of records and thinking, okay, there it is. There's your life's work, Darren. And now it is that, but it's also something that's online, and it's like, what are you? What is your work? And what did you do if it's not findable, if it's not there? And so I was very happy to have someone offer to sort that out for me. And the violence, some people were actually a bit cross with me. Like my friend Andy was actually quite cross with me about the fact that wasn't online. It's like that he is of the opinion. He is of the opinion it's my best album, and also it's my most metal album, because he loves Iron Maiden. And he says it's so metal, that album. I don't think he means it sounds metal, but just in the fact that it's about, you know, people being hung in the 17th century. In that sense, it's metal. And so I'm very pleased to have that be released, because he might be right. He might be right. It might. It's not impossible, but it might be my best album. It's not. It might be.
And one of the things it sort of talks about is Civil War, obviously, and the witch trials. But it seems to have a what do they call it? Murder of Seagulls? Suddenly, I don't know what they call it. And I suppose cliche, but certain marginalized groups are sort of, you could look at history and sort of then relate it back to current day, can't you, in a way? Marginalized groups and how fear is sort of weaponized, I guess.
Yeah, I don't mind that. At the time I was writing it, it was more about what was happening in the world was the aftermath of 9/11, and that kind of our persecution. I mean, we're always persecuting all sorts of others and all sorts of minorities, but if I was thinking about a persecution then, it would have been more race and how we were thinking of Muslims as otherness, not us outsiders to be persecuted. But I think it wouldn't be for me to say, but I do like the record in that sense. It's just it's a record about fear and how frightened it is to be persecuted. And so you could apply that to anything you wanted, really. You could, if you wanted, I'm not saying somebody who is suffering from transphobia could listen to this record, I'm not saying, but I don't know. It's just about that. It's about being oppressed and persecuted. And it always seems to be relevant. It always seems to be relevant, that stuff. When I was planning the record and thinking you're going to write a record about, you know, women being hung for being witches, I did think that there was a kind of a heavy metal or true crime serial killer, or even Hammer House. I mean, and there was a horror film about the Witchfinder General. There was these approaches that one could take, And I was keen not to do that. I was keen to try my hardest to have it largely told from a victim's perspective.
Yeah.
I had a friend who is no longer with us, a guy called James McMahon, who used to write for Enemy and Kerrang. And he used to write about serial killers and true crime quite a lot. And he used to say, it's okay to write about this stuff as long as you're always considering the victim's voice or something like that. I paraphrase him. But he said something about always considering the victim. Mm. And I think at one point, I even considered that the violence should only be sung in first person with women's voices. I never went quite that far, but I considered it at one point. I was like, oh, what if you don't even hear a man on it? But you do hear a man, and that man is me. The other thing that the violence was about was the fact that I got attacked and beaten up quite badly just before that record. And when bad things happen to you as a songwriter, people tend to go, oh, well, that's okay, you can write a song about it. So I sort of thought, oh, well, fuck you, I won't, but I sort of did. So I was able to sort of smuggle being terrified of being beaten up again into that as well. So I was able to sort of perhaps look at my own experience of being a victim and sort of sneak that subject matter into an album covertly.
And was there an inspiration? Was there any text you were sort of reading around that, you know, of that period that inspired it?
Oh,
was it?
I mean, I worked really, really fucking hard on researching it.
Yeah.
I read tons on it. I took it seriously. I remember one point getting really, I had two things I remember. I remember once I had a lyric about someone head on a pillow, like the word pillow had come up. And then I suddenly thought, did they have pillows? Or did only the middle class or the upper class have pillows? Or did poor people have pillows?
Yeah.
And then remembering spending about a week trying to work out who had pillows. And I had a similar thing with a lyric about a window pane, about a bird tapping on a window pane. I was like, did they have glaziers then? Did every house have a window, or did only rich people say the same thing? But that, both of those, all of that, what I just said, might not be the question you're asking. You might.
No, it's all interesting.
What you might be asking is was there a singular thing that made me think
just
that
you got references to specific figures, haven't you?
I started writing about Essex, where I was from. So I'd already done a couple of albums themed around Essex, and I started to feel that my lyric style would always use slang and idiomatic language. Like I'd always, not always, but I like trying to write lyrics that are similar to the way I speak or the way my friends speak. And I had this idea that if I wrote something historical, that would cause me to have to write lyrics in a different way. And it would mean like loads of my normal tropes were gone. And so I had the idea to write something historical that was set in the past. And so then I thought, what big events happened in Essex, in my home county? And then I found this. Then I found this. I thought, okay, this could be a record. So that's how I arrived at the idea.
Okay. Did the research into the different characters and different figures
It's you learn a lot. I mean, I've said this a lot before, so it's not necessarily giving you a an exclusive thing here, but like, sorry. I always think of songs as quite fragile little vehicles, you know, like little carts or something. And really, to make a song work, you know, you've often only got, you know, 16 lines, you know, to get something across. And often the chorus is going to be something repeated. So you can't load them with too much information, otherwise the wheels fall off. And so when you're researching all this stuff, you find out lots of interesting things. I found this whole thing about bread, that they would re-ferment bread and use bits of bread over and over to make bread, and that when they kept doing that, it was probably having some hallucinogenic quality, possibly making people believe there was imps flying around, and maybe people thinking that, you know, there was black magic happening. And I sort of read this thing and found it really interesting and read some more about it, but I couldn't make it a song. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't make an interesting song about, you know, reusing bread too much and it turning into hallucinogenic. Because I think like songs still have to be about the big things, you know, about love or jealousy, or in this case, fear. And so, so as much as I researched, I think I learned that you can't put all the research in the songs.
Yeah,
that's a little tricky, you know. It still has to be. I'm still trying to deal in pop songs.
Yeah. You've also announced a second album by, as The French. Is that right? I read.
Well, yes. Ooh, we made one. We made lots. In fact, we made about two albums worth of stuff when we made the first album, and also we made a second one which never got released. And also, me and John sometimes think about making another one, but Jamie in sort of tried to tidy up the back catalogue, said, well, what else have you got? And I said, well, I think there's another album by The French. So yes, I think we are going to release.
So that's that. Part of the sort of archive project, really, in a way.
Yeah, and I think that makes it a little more exciting for me, rather than us just finding old records that weren't out. There's also another record from about 7 or 8 years ago that I kind of forgot to release. So there's a few things like that. So we are finding some albums as well to release, as well as just stuff that's disappeared from streaming.
And you've also put back online certain Hefner albums with bonus tracks as well. I suppose the cliche question there is, I mean, I know they're probably available, but you sort of, that's part of your sort of tidying up process or whatever.
Well, I think also part of the tidying up process is putting them up there without the extra tracks as well.
Yeah.
Which Jamie made me aware of. And he was like, why don't we just put the records up? Because we had like longer versions of things. And I thought, oh, actually, you're right. When I'm looking through streaming, I do that. I sort of see three different versions of the same album, and then basically I try and work out, well, what's the album just as it is?
Yeah,
because that's the one I want to listen to.
Yeah,
and it occurred to me I wasn't really giving people the same service, you know. So,
I suppose the cliche question is, does revisiting those albums sort of give you a different perspective or a different? You know, does it change your opinion on the records, I guess, for me anyway?
Yeah, it does. I started a couple of years ago, I started a Patreon.
Yeah.
And on the Patreon, I do commentaries. So I'll have an album playing and I'll I'll talk through the album for people that want to know more about it. It does actually quite often make me feel a bit sad, actually. It just makes me feel a bit sad sometimes. It's just, I had a girlfriend once who said that all photos are sad, like all of them. They're all sad. They just remind you of the past. You can't get back there. It's gone. It's over. Mm. And sometimes records do that. I think one reason why my back catalogue is in a mess, and one reason why it isn't possible to get all my albums, and one reason why it isn't in order online, is because I do find it slightly distressing to look at my past too much.
Yeah.
But yes, and part of that distress and part of that distress is learning things about what you did. You know, sometimes I think things are shit. Sometimes I listen to a record and think, it's a bit shit actually. You didn't do that right. Sometimes not. Sometimes I think something's brilliant, but even that can make me sad because I sometimes think, oh, could you do that now? Could you do something as good as that now? So that makes me sad. Not very easy to please, am I? But I suppose
that's a bit of imposter syndrome that most creative people have, though, isn't it? I know I do as well.
Yeah, it is. But it sort of brings us full circle to where we started off in the conversation, because I guess my solution is like to go, oh, well, never mind, make another record.
Yeah, yeah.
Quickly go make another record. And that's what I don't understand about a lot of musicians, why they don't have the same,
yeah,
the same escape route.
Yeah, it's the, yeah. There is a sort of a nostalgia. What do they call it? Retromania. It was a book, wasn't it?
But something, yeah. Who was that?
Simon Reynolds.
I find it's okay. I don't mind, and you can learn something from it. But when I see artists sort of, oh, we're doing a whole reissue campaign. We're going to spend the next 3 years doing it. And I guess, I mean, maybe I've got an advantage by not being that successful. I think if you're more successful, then you have so many people telling you that you've got to do a tour.
Yeah.
Playing the 20th anniversary of
such and such album.
Yeah. No one's telling me to do that. And also, no one in the industry is telling me to do that. But also, no fans are telling me to do that either. Like, there is literally doesn't seem to be any demand for that. So that's okay. So that's good. So I don't have to, like, when I play a show at, you know, say the Lexington in London, I've sort of trained my audience quite well. They, you know, no one really shouts out the songs that I hate. because also I don't have any, you know, I just didn't have, I didn't have that one song that got on daytime radio all the time, so I don't have to do that.
It's interesting because I'd obviously heard of Hefner, but I had this girlfriend in the early 2000s. She said to me, "Oh, I really like Hefner. You know their second album, Fidelity Wars."
And yeah,
she was, the hymn for cigarettes. She was sending me. Uh-huh. I was like, "Oh, I really like that." Yeah, yeah. And I suppose it's interesting that, you know. So that happens less now, doesn't it?
She sounds perfect. Why didn't you marry her instead?
Oh, it's a long story, but you know, it just. I suppose that's the kind of thing that happened then.
I think
it does happen now, but it's a bit. You were talking about the algorithm before.
I think that Hefner and being a John Peel band and songs like Him for the Cigarettes and Him for the Alcohol and those songs definitely facilitate my life now. And the reason why I can make double albums about the witch trials and walk around the English countryside doing Fenton Villages, I definitely am able to do that because of Hefner, because of that time. But I still think it's a bit different to say being, I don't really want to name names. But
I totally get what you mean.
If I'd been just a little more successful, and if him for the cigarettes had been properly top 40 or something like that, I think it would be much more of a hindrance to me. I'd probably be a bit richer, but I probably would still be doing, you know, playing
anniversary tours, reunions,
and that's fine. I mean, I know I'm weird. Like, I know that, I know.
Well, it sounds like it suits you rather than, you know.
It suits me, and I like the way I am, and I don't mind. I just still am a little, I still find it a little odd that I'm so on my own. You know, when I'm on a table of musicians, and I sit there and go, oh, fucking hell, I hate playing live. It's horrible. I like being in a room on my own, making 10 songs really quickly and release all the time. And most musicians look at me like, what are you on about, Darren? Playing live's the best bit. I was like, oh, is it? Oh, right. So I do, I like the way I am, but I still am sometimes ever so slightly frustrated I don't have more allies.
Yeah, you know? I totally get that. But not everyone sort of, you know, how can I put it? I'm a bit of an introvert. Yeah, last week I did an open mic, and I've never done anything like that because I'm not really a performer. Do you know what I mean?
As a comedian or a musician?
No, no. I what it is, this is, you know, I don't want to turn it into about me, but I did I was involved in a community music mental health group last year, and we're basically all got mental health, or a couple of them have got like sort of brain injuries, a couple of the members of the group. We got together to sort of write a song and to do some covers and stuff and do a performance at the end of it. Anyway, we've carried it on, so but last week we did a like an open mic, just three songs or whatever. And I'm not really a performer. I'm just like the most average sort of rhythm guitarist going. So I found it quite hard. I was expected to get some like, you know, oh yeah, that was great. But actually I found it quite like, I was concentrating so much because I'm the rhythm guitarist and we didn't have a drummer or anything. So, I suppose everyone's different. I suppose that's what I'm trying to get to, you know.
Have you heard the expression, and I think this is maybe true, that however good you are, you're a year behind on stage. So however good a guitarist you are, when you get on stage, nerves, the room and everything sets you back a year. So you become about as good as you were a year ago. So like everything you can do.
There were two songs that I didn't know off by heart. So basically I had to keep looking at what I was doing, playing. Do you know what I mean? So
I still have things like that. I still have certain songs where I go, here we go. I still forget words on stage and do it. I do.
You've got excuse though, because you've got a vast back catalogue. I suppose what I'm trying to say is we're not all sort of, some of us might prefer, like you were talking about, you might prefer more the act of, or the right songwriting process, or the recording process.
I do think it's a shame that performing music and doing music well favors the extrovert. I think that's a shame. I don't know. I think I possibly am an extrovert, really, or I don't know. But like, I do think that there are plenty of people that are very quiet and withdrawn and have amazing ideas. And it's a little harder for us to find those people, which might have something to do with what we're talking about. That you know, just because sometimes the people with the who can shout the loudest get heard more quickly. And open mics can be amazing for that. It can be amazing for just because, you know, whatever you're doing on any level, to have it heard out loud.
Yeah.
You know, it's part of the learning experience.
Actually, somebody took a video and actually didn't sound as bad as I remember. But it's always that thing, isn't it? You always remember the bit that went wrong rather than, it's a bit like that with writing as well. And, you know, maybe songwriting as well. It's like the bit that went wrong is the bit you focus on more than the bit that went wrong.
Yeah, it is. And also, unfortunately, I don't think we're supposed to like what we do. Unfortunately, I don't think that's the deal, which is a really stupid part of the deal. So I will spend, you know, all day trying to write a song or make a song great. And all I want to do really is make a song that I would want to listen to. That's the only thing I can do. That's what else would I be trying to do? I'm trying to make a song that I would think is brilliant. What do I want to hear? The song I'm next going to write. That's what I want to hear. And when as soon as I've done it, it's the last thing in the world I'm ever going to listen to. Because why would I listen to me? And it's sort of, I think some people are fans of what they do, but I just think they're a bit weird and fucked up. but I don't think you're supposed to like.
No, I understand what you're saying.
And I think you're supposed to see the video of you. You're supposed to watch the video of your open mic, and you're supposed to cringe, and you're supposed to go, "Oh dear, that's me." And then afterwards, someone says, "Do you want to do it again?" And you go, "Yeah, all right." and you try and do it better. It's
a really it's an stupid experience anyway. Yeah, see, we've been meeting every other week for quite a few months, just playing songs in a studio, in a rehearsal room, so it's a different vibe, isn't it?
The thing that's brilliant, and I bet it's happened in your experience of doing that, the thing that is, because I feel like I've been a little bit negative, the thing that I think is magical is accidents and one of these times you'll have an idea and you'll be going from G to C and someone else will forget that it was C and they'll play a D over the top of the C and there'll be this weird thing and you'll go, "Oh, hold on, I quite like that." And you'll be able to say to someone, "I thought what you were doing was good." And they go, "Oh, okay, should I do it again?" And those moments are what you're there for. Those are the moments that make it really worthwhile doing it. They're the brilliant things. When you have two people and then something happens between those two people, which couldn't have happened from either person on their own, I find that genuinely to be quite magical. Like, I think, how did that happen? How did we just create a piece of music that didn't exist previously? I couldn't have done it on my own and you couldn't have done it on your own. And I think that, I hope that's what you're experiencing sometimes.
Definitely. And, I have enjoyed it when we've been doing it in the rehearsal. I think it's because I was concentrating so hard afterwards. I just felt like quite tired and sort of, a little bit like, "Oh, well, that didn't go well. This bit didn't go well," rather than actually it actually went not bad considering we haven't written it.
Recording can be like this for a lot of people as well. Yeah. A lot of people have real problems with the red light. And in the same way, as I said, your standard of playing can decrease by a year by going on stage. Some people are like that with recording. And so they have the song already and then they go into the studio and then the drummer or somebody just falls to bits because the idea of this is the time when it has to be perfect and this is the time when you have to play it the best you've ever played it. And some people find recording equally as traumatic as performing live. I think lots of people have their first experience of recording studios being something like that, being, "Oh, holy fuck, what's this about?" Takes a bit of adjustment to get used to that as much as playing live does.
I also read that you're doing painting classes. Is that right?
Well, I think I am, yeah. There's going to be one in a couple of weeks' time. I mean, I did do teacher training a long time ago and I never did anything with it. I just trained to become a teacher and then didn't do it, mainly because I discovered that being a teacher is really, really hard work and writing songs isn't that hard work, so I decided to write songs instead. But I find a lot of things transferable between music and art. I find a lot of the lessons that I could teach in music are transferable to art. And I think after I left art college myself and decided that perhaps I was better suited to making music than I was art, I found that lots of things I'd been told in my art lessons I could apply to music. I think they influence each other quite well in my brain anyway.
Mm. And do you get something out of teaching others? Do you find
I do think about this
myself as well at the moment.
I do. I'm not I don't do it often, and I do teach both a bit. I a couple of about a month ago, I went to Falmouth University and taught some kids about songwriting. It's a good way of finding out what you know yourself. You know, you sometimes find yourself saying something as a lesson, and then your internal monologue says, actually, when was the last time you did that? Like your teacher something, it's like, actually, I don't do that ever, that thing I'm saying. So you can be reminded of the lessons you know that you don't use. You can learn from students and pupils all the time, because people are weird and fascinating and everyone's completely different. And so sometimes talking about this music experience of teaching music a month ago, you can go into a room and, I don't know, a kid who's like 18 or 19 can play you their song, and you can go, what the fuck was that? I have no understanding of what you did. You know, I mean, in a positive way, like in a completely positive way. You know, they might say, well, what should I do next? Like, I have no idea. Like, that's brilliant. And I think you should just do what you should do. So it's not necessarily, particularly in the arts, like in maths and science, there's like empirically correct answers.
Yeah.
But in what we do, there isn't really a right or wrong answer. So, you know, the exchange of ideas and lessons can go both ways. And then they learn something. Oh, wow, he thought that was brilliant and he didn't know what to say to me. I've learned something about myself.
And you mentioned you've got a Patreon, you've got a never-ending singles club. How do you find Patreon as a platform? Because I've supported a few artists on there over the years, and I do wonder sometimes, I suppose in your case, because you're constantly creating and things, is there a feeling sometimes as maybe like a demand of like feeding it? I don't know.
Yeah,
I do wonder if that can be a thing.
There is. I feel like I should have been called out a little bit more for being a hypocrite, because I was really quite skeptical of crowdfunding and things like that when it first started. I am skeptical of putting too much of yourself out there and making yourself the culture of your face always being on things like Instagram and always having to talk about what you're doing and constantly pulling the screen back. Hey, here I am at soundcheck. Here I am washing my hands. Here I am on my allotment. I haven't done that, actually. I think actually a video of me and my allotment would probably be quite good, actually. I do have doubts about it, and I'm not highly comfortable all the time. But sometimes I am, and sometimes I think it's quite nice. Sometimes I just think, oh, actually, it's just a little club of people who
supporting
our common interest is me. And I think sometimes if I just allow myself to be a bit more myself, then it's okay. And I think what I need to do is I need to do more little things more often. So I think sometimes if I'm sort of doing something, like I'm halfway through a song and I'm just having a break, maybe I should chat to someone about this. Like, and that someone, rather than being a pal, can just be the patron. Oh, hi everyone, I'm doing this or whatever. I don't know. I'm not sure what to say about it, really. I went into it, you know, much in the way I've gone into other things that we've talked about in this interview, and I'd sort of decided, and I looked at other artists and I saw them, different things they could do. And I thought, well, the thing I can do that most artists can't do is I could, you know, I've just got hard drives and hard drives of songs. And I thought, I can just release a song, two songs every month. Like, I could do it without breaking a sweat. Like, I could do it without recording. Like, I've probably got another 2 years just on my hard drive. I don't need to do anything. I just need to pick them. So I thought, oh, that's interesting. That's what I've got that lots of other people haven't got. And so I feel like, seeing as my USP is I do too much stuff and should edit it down, then that should be my Patreon. My Patreon should also be it's too much. And oddly, I actually think some people leave my Patreon because of that. I think even people who quite like me go, Darren, I got to leave because I just haven't listened to the last 5 hours, you know?
So, yeah, yeah.
let me say quickly, because I sound like I'm being negative, join my Patreon. Because I think it is great, and I do.
Yeah. Did you get good feedback on there, like of things you post and stuff like that? Might give you an idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to treat it like the people there are somewhere between friends and fans. It's not, there's not quite a word for what they are, but they're somewhere in between. So in this sense, you know, when people ask me, oh, what do you think of this, or do you think of that, or da da da, I just reply, it's okay. I would say, though, having said that, and said my Patreon is great and please all join, but I would say that it is another arm of social media. And if you have, and I'm saying to you, Bill, if you have some sort of problems, anxiety over social media, as I do, it isn't any different to that. It has some of the same pitfalls. And it's bizarrely low-key upsetting when someone leaves. So you turn on the Patreon and says, da-da-da has unsubscribed. And you're like, oh. Oddly, it hurts your feelings a little bit. It definitely is another part, another extension of that world. So I think just make sure we've got our armor on, with some of it. You know, I've seen some friends just on Instagram do things that I wouldn't now. I think there has to be a line somewhere with how much of yourself you're gonna put on, you know.
I do wonder sometimes, especially young artists. I do think, because a couple of artists I followed on Patreon, and I almost felt like they were sort of coming up with things to try and coming up with things to put on there, which I totally get. But I do wonder then, the pressure, you know, and the.
No, I mean, I do too. I mean, I do too. I mean, I do. I mean, sometimes I'm painting and I think, hold on, shall I do a little bit to camera, tell them what I'm doing?
Yeah.
I'm doing this thing tomorrow. This will be good. I can make it work and I can make it fun and I can make friends for it and I can make it interesting and all of it. But if the arse absolutely fell out of Instagram and Patreon and all these things and record sales suddenly multiplied by 10, I would be so happy to pretend it was 1982 and you just let me make a record every 5 or 6 months, I put it out, and then someone sends me a check. Yeah. I would prefer that. But
even 1992.
But I am...
Different world.
But at the same time, I'm...
You're grateful for people who support you.
Grateful for people that support me. and I'm willing to try and make the best of it.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to, so I think hopefully the way I look at these things is, how can I make what I do fit this? And I think the thing with Instagram and Blue Sky, the secret weapon I have is paintings, I suppose. So I don't feel that I have to say something every day. I don't feel like I have to say what I think about, you know, the blocking of the, you know, Strait of Hormuz or you know, the toilet ban. I mean, I think most people would know what I think about those things. So I don't need to say it. I think people would know what I'd think about those things. So instead I can say, here's a painting of Paul McCartney's shoes. Is that okay? And I sort of hope it is okay. Like, I hope that there is room for someone who's just paints pictures of Paul McCartney's shoes. Like, hopefully that still has a use, you know, so...
Well, the visual, and, you know, that often cuts through the algorithm, doesn't it? And often people talk about algorithm these days. It's just, yeah, it's gone.
Sort of, yeah, like, unfortunately, I think the other thing. I mean, I think the other thing about the algorithm is I think we're all guessing. Like, I don't think any of us really fucking know, do we?
No.
But the other thing, I think possibly that is working for the algorithm, or at least what people are saying is your own face and your own voice. So what's happening with artists is they're tending to sort of would you like to see my picture, and they have it with the back showing, and they turn it slowly so that it takes, you know, 10 or 20 seconds for you to see the picture. So then, of course, you pause over the Instagram. You know, it's just endless, isn't it? It's just hell.
Technique, you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I just wondered, because I watched a few videos the other day talking about artists complaining about the algorithm. And these were some quite big artists, like Lizzo, who was actually probably somebody maybe 5 years ago who benefited from the algorithm. Maybe in her case, there are other reasons, but yeah, she's like complaining that her album isn't getting as much traction this time around because of the algorithm, etc.
I don't know about Lizzo's situation, and without knowing anything, she could be absolutely right, and you know, good luck to her. I suppose, like, you'll never hear about people talking about the problem if it's only tiny, teeny people like me talking about it. But I do sort of think, do you remember, are you old enough to remember Status Quo trying to sue Radio One for not playing their single? Status Quo decided they were going to try and sue Radio One because Radio One hadn't been there, and they said, well, no,
Status
Quo.
I think Cliff Richard, something similar, wasn't it?
I think Cliff Richard also did a similar thing around the same time, or at least, if not suing, just openly complained. And I remember thinking at the time, that's not a good look. And even though we've talked here about the algorithm, and how it is to be an artist, I'm grateful that we spent the first half talking about some record stuff. I think, like, I just don't know if it would look that good if I talked about it. Like, don't talk about the algorithm on the algorithm, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
So, when I see people on Blue Sky saying, how do I get the reach of whatever, da-da-da, I want people to listen to my records because I broke their fucking heart. You know, I ripped their heart out, or indeed I repaired their heart after a breakup. Or I did. So I don't really want to pull the curtain away. I don't really want to sort of people see the nuts and bolts and hear about me saying, the algorithm's not working for me.
Yeah,
and I think in that sense, I do feel for Lizzo, but I think just concentrate on breaking people's hearts. Concentrate on that. That's the thing to do, you know.
Yeah.
Also, who needs to fucking hear it from me? You know what I mean? Like, you know, there's better people to talk about it.
Well, I suppose it all goes back to a bit of there isn't like that mystery in a way, I suppose, is there, if you're totally giving away everything. And like you said, ultimately it's the music that attracts you, the first thing it attracts you.
I remember going to see the House of Love.
Yeah.
And I remember going to see the House of Love when the early lineup with Terry Bickers, and the album would come out in Creation.
Yeah.
And I went to see him at the Pink Toothbrush. And Terry Bickers was doing his thing with his guitar, and I was standing in front of him at the front, and it was so loud. And his guitar was doing this, rah, 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 sounding like a fucking jet engine. And I just thought, I have no fucking idea what's happening. I don't understand how you're doing that. What the hell are you doing? And, you know, about 2 years later, I did find out. It's like, oh, it's a chorus pedal. And then, like, oh, did I lose something? I suppose I gained something and I lost something. I found out how it happened. I still can't really do what Terry Bickers does. Of course I can't. But I sometimes think of that as an example of, like, I don't need to, like, people don't need to understand everything about what you do. And I don't need to understand. I do not understand anything about what John Coltrane does. Like that's far beyond me. That's the kind of music I have no understanding of. And I don't think I want to understand it.
You know, yeah, and sometimes when you find, like you said, sometimes when you find out it's actually quite mundane, or, you know, or it's something you didn't think it was, but then you have your own interpretation, and that's fine as well. So
yeah, yeah.
As long as it, you know, moved you in some way, that's art, isn't it, I suppose.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've gone a bit longer than I thought, but I'll just ask you about what you've got coming up at the moment.
I'm trying to finish an album of instrumentals, short guitar instrumentals. So I think it will be an album of 20 guitar instrumentals. I think that might be the next record when I get it finished.
Cool. cool. And is that just you, or is that a sort of band?
That's
record?
Just me.
Okay. Yeah, because you've had various different lineups.
Yeah, we are working on a second New Starts album.
Yeah,
That's taken longer than I hoped. But we'll get there. Yeah.
And you did a tour with David Gedge, Wedding Present, and you're doing another show with him in September. I'm reading here.
Yeah. I think there's a little tour. That's interesting. I play my songs, then I interview him, then he does his songs.
Okay.
That's okay. Cool. That's all right. Yeah. I do what you're doing now, which is a bit weird because you have to do it several nights. And so by about the third night, you're like, do we do the same questions again? Or like, do we do it like a set list, or do we change it? So that's happening in the autumn. I think this time I'm just going to have to talk to David. Like, it's okay to repeat some of them, isn't it?
I think. You do wonder if some of those like comedy tours actually, don't you? Or like your Q&A tours. You do wonder, like, how much of it is scripted. And
I mean, this interview's been good because I think I've certainly have said a few things that I don't normally say, but once or twice, even in this, it's okay because in some ways you sort of like, oh, actually, I've got an okay answer for this. I know the answer for it. So you can't do it all the time, but sometimes somebody asks a question and you've been asked it before, and it's like, actually, it is a good question to ask, and luckily I've got quite a well-rehearsed answer.
So yeah, of course. I suppose I'm just thinking of those ones that are so well-rehearsed, you do think that it is a total... I totally get it.
Well, do you ever see the Kevin Eldon sketch about George Martin? You can find it on YouTube.
Possibly.
And he just George Martin constantly asking the same questions, and it's like, oh well, and then Paul came up with this melody, and I thought it was lovely, and da 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 da, and then
that's what George, it feels like watching Anthology, you know?
Yeah. And then George Martin saw it, and I think Kevin Eldon might be a bit upset about it, but George Martin just went, "People keep asking me the same questions.
What
else am I supposed to say?" And I thought that was quite sweet. But it's like he was upset about it because it's like I can't help you if they keep asking me the same things.
I won't name who it was, but I went to an arena show. It was a Q&A for two sort of quite big comedy writers, and they were doing a Q&A, and it did seem literally like, I mean, there were a couple of questions from the audience and stuff, but generally it was a guy asking them questions, and it did seem totally scripted. But, I totally get it because, you know, if you're, you're doing
I think maybe
several what I should, nights in a row, then,
yeah.
You know.
I think maybe what I should do with David Gedge then is ask some questions that he's used to, but maybe I should try and think of at least one new one every night. Maybe that's what I should do. So at least every night there's something new, even if it's just for us. Maybe that's what I should do.
Yeah, and sometimes some things come up, don't they, that you didn't expect and things. But where do people go if they want to listen to your music, buy your music, sign up to your Patreon? Is it Bandcamp or
they know Patreon? How to do it. They know.
I'll probably put links in anyway.
They know how to use the internet. They'll find me.
I know. It's just one of those questions I always ask because I think, well, there's usually a link that somebody wants you to go to. All right, anyway, thanks for talking to me. And
thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to In the Spotlight with myself, Bill Cummings. I've been joined today by Darren Heyman.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Thank you very much. Bye.